I'm going to begin the interview now. All right, I'm here today with Selina Mkoni, the Program Director at the Public Service Management Ministry in Tanzania. It is the 18th of November, 2008, and we're at Utumishi Building in Dar es Salaam. Before we start the interview, I just want to ask that you have agreed to this interview.
Yes, I have.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'd like to begin this conversation by talking about the role you've played in civil service reform. And could you tell me about what you do now and the jobs that have brought you to this position?
Well, I joined the public service office. By then it was known as Civil Service Department in 1994 as an accountant. And later on, I was assigned the duties of administration of the program as well. By then, it was Civil Service Reform Program that was more concerned with cost containment, restructuring of the government, reducing the size of the government, because earlier on, coming in from my socialist society, the government used to do almost everything. Therefore, it became a huge burden to the government, and therefore they need to streamline and focus more on the critical role of governments, which is policy development and management, formulation and management, and rule of law, etc., rather than really offering the services that could be offered by other non-state actors. That program lasted from 94 to 98, when a new program was developed, which was more focused on performance management, institutional performance management systems, and as well as making the public service efficient. The program that was designed in 98 was launched by His Excellency William Benjamin Mkapa in 2000, and it was to last for 12 years. This program was phased, which had the first phase for 5 years, more concerned with developing tools to manage the public service so that it performs efficiently and effectively. The second phase was more on instituting this performance management system and tools as instruments that can help the government perform better. And the third phase was more on quality assurance. Now it becomes a norm to practice and operate efficiently by the public service in saving the mass. So when I was in the civil service reform as accountant cum administrator, I assumed the same role with PSRP with PSRP, until it also closed in 2007 in December. A new program, the next phase, was designed. Since things were changing, we needed to redesign the earlier designed phase. So what we call PSRP 2 now is, now I'm the project coordinator, more managing the components rather than the really doing in terms of accounting and administration. My rise into these positions is more attributed to my ability to team play. I'm a very good team player. I also very innovative. There are several things that I changed as I was carrying out the program, which is avoiding to be at the top, but rather working with everybody across the line, more on a horizontal basis rather than vertical. And this gave me to be accepted by everybody and to be liked by everybody to run the program, because they seemed to be running the program, although I was more on a facilitation role rather than a managing role. That one, even when they were now, since the first phase ended, we had to be recruited, because we couldn't move to the next phase without a competitive age. So they advertised for the post, and fortunately I managed to also get recruited under this phase because of my experience and the capacity in carrying out the reforms. And public service reform program is one of the best in the region. And I know that our permanent secretary had been awarded by the World Bank for, you know, being able to lead the program well, while Mr. William Heto. So this was all because of the consistency and persistence in ensuring reforms become successful.
Thank you. All right, this is part two of the interview with Mr. McCourney. So could you talk about the challenges and issues facing the civil service before the reforms were started?
Some of the challenges were lack of systems to operate and to run the government. The issue I mentioned about the government taking up all the tasks instead of, you know, concentrating on the core functions, and therefore it became a burden by the public servants to carry out their duties efficiently. So for lack of that, then we had to undertake reforms so that we streamline the government, we look at the cost of running the government, and that's how the reforms have emerged in this country. And it has been done in phases. As I said, the first phase, which was civil service reform, was more to restructure the government and rationalize functions. And then the next phase was to put in tools that will make the public service offer better services and efficiently to the public.
Okay. And could you talk about some of the specific goals of the civil service reform program and how these goals were decided on?
Some of the goals that were, as I said, restructuring, and therefore there was retrenchment of employees, looking at the capacity of the employee of the public service so that it can perform. You could have dead wood in the system, and therefore you will not be able to efficiently offer the services. And another goal was really to concentrate on the core business of the government, which is policy formulation and the managing rule of law, things like that. So those were the utmost goals for the earlier reforms. Right now the goal is more on poverty reduction and growth for the citizen. And therefore we have a vision, National Vision 2025, which stipulates that, and a strategy for that matter, which we call Mkukuta, which is now the vision in which the nation is steering all its effort towards reduction in poverty reduction.
So could you spell Mkukuta?
Mkukuta in Swahili is mkakati wa kukuza uchumi na kupunguza umaskini, but in English it is National Strategy for Growth and Poverty Reduction. National Strategy for Growth and Poverty Reduction, NGISRP.
Right, and how does the restructuring of the civil service fit in with those goals?
First, it was to make it lean. As another, it was, and also to look at the core functions, and also to see what can be hived off in terms of other entities taking them up. For example, we introduced what we called executive agencies, so that some ministries that were more on an economic venture could have an agency that was dealing with the business type of services that are crucial for government to still continue doing. Issues of utility. Utilities is a very crucial issue which any government should be on top of, and therefore the executive agencies were created as you have your eyes on but hands off, kind of to reduce the bureaucracy that exists in the former government that existed during the civil service reforms. Also, we did introduce a private sector participation into some of the services, and therefore we contracted out services to the private sector.
What sort of services did you contract out?
We did contract out cleaning, messengerial, as well as security. Those are the commonly outsourced services across the government right now. But each ministry, when we did carry out this program of PSP, we call it PSP, they did identify areas where they can still buy PSP, but then it needs the sequencing and timing. So when the time is opportune, other services will also be outsourced so that the government really remains with its core business.
Okay, and what is the relationship of the executive agencies to
the ministry?
To the ministries?
As I said, it's eyes on and hands off. So the permanent secretary of the ministry chairs the board of the executive agency to know how it is running. But it's more run on a business entity. So they do make business plans rather than a strategic plan.
And who else would be on the board of these?
There would be people from outside in relation to that executive agency. If it is on the utility part of it, then you have people who are in power, energy, and water. And therefore, it's well selected to have an encompassing and participatory body that can inform better the operations of the agency.
Right, and how successful do you think these have been?
Some have been quite successful. Like we have one which is like a business registration and licensing agency. It used to be very tedious to register business, but now BRELA is doing very well. We had the registration insolvency and trusteeship agency, RITA, which is to register birth and deaths. Also, there was a lot of bureaucracy, but now it has been streamlined and they're running on a commercial, rather a more unbureaucratic mode, so services are quite improved. Moving from getting a birth certificate in from 3 years to 1 to 3 days. Yeah.
Okay. And have there been others that have been less successful? And can you think about why they've been less successful?
I wouldn't say they have been less, but rather it's the nature of the agents themselves. Because some of the agencies really, they still are offering basic services, and therefore they have to get subvention from the government. And therefore they will still have a relative kind of situation.
Okay. Could you talk a bit about the motivation for civil service reform?
When it was introduced, there was always the issue, how will the ministries and public servants themselves take up the reforms? It was a challenge. And so when we began in the civil service reform program, they had what they would say local cost compensation. They would compensate those who were more involved with the reform program better than the rest, so that there was some kind of a buy-in to start with. I wouldn't know whether it was a kind of using the Pareto 20-80 principle, that you have few on board who, when others see the successes that come in, they will join. Another issue that we took on board was the issue of quick win. We looked for situations where you could change fast. And some of the quick wins we did with the Minister of Lands with the title deeds, because also it was taking a lot of time. Therefore, when we picked up about more than 10 quick wins and they showed success, these were quite an incentive for others to also participate in reforms.
Was there an effort to sit down and plan the process or the order in which things were done? And who was involved in that process?
Can you come again, please?
So was there an effort to sit down and plan the civil service reform process, and who was involved in that planning?
There were people who sat, and there were studies actually that were carried out earlier before the civil service reform program in the 1993s and later on. The civil service reform, which was a 5-year, was also on the like a diagnostic. So diagnostic studies were undertaken, as well as when we carried out the civil service reform program, then we knew where we should take the program, the next phase of the program, and therefore a group of public servants undertook development of the strategy for the next reform program. So there were about 25 of them from various ministries, at the level of directors and assistant directors. They grew and developed the strategy for the public service reform program. And it was being championed by the public service management. I mean, this office championed the development of the phase of PSRP. And even as we develop the next phase, like which we did last year, it's also about getting stakeholders' views, doing some, carrying out a study, and literally looking around and asking what do they perceive to be the best way to do it and what are the consequences after we did it. So it is very involving and participatory.
Okay. At this point, how do you think this planning has worked out? Have you been able to follow through on those plans? And what would you change in those plans if you were to start again?
For us, it has really worked very well from one phase to another because of the approach in which we designed the phases and the way forward, which is quite the involving type of. We have had other reforms that have stagnated, and it's all about leadership. Who is leading that reform, and how enthusiastic and committed that leadership is to that reform program. And therefore, our reform has really been very fortunate that it has always had the backing from the top level of the president to the chief secretary and to the rest of the government.
And who would you describe as the constituents for the reform?
The constituents is the top executive, which is His Excellency the President, because they have always launched the programs, they have always written the foreword for the program, and therefore that gives it a very committed level.
My next set of questions are going to deal with some specific kinds of reform in which you've played a role. And if you don't have much experience, just let me know and we can move on to the next set of questions. And I'd particularly just like to know your experience behind these, behind your role in this. So if I'd like to talk about professionalization and merit-based recruitment and hiring. And could you describe the procedures and standards used in the system of recruitment in the civil service? And how has this changed over the period of the reform program?
The earlier public service was more on nepotism, or who, and therefore it was not on merit. And therefore, with the coming of the reform, one of the issues that was high on the agenda also was recruitment on merit, and we had a full component on meritocracy, that you hire for the quality and for the job that is around. Otherwise, people are just joining the public service haphazardly. So the reform concentrated on that as one of its key achievements in building the capacity of the public service, getting the best. The issue of retaining them now in the service was a challenge too, because of the wage and the salary that is paid to the public servants. So fortunately, earlier on, people didn't want to join the public service. But with the reforms, it became more palatable to join the service because there was future. People could see there is future in the public service. And that really helped a lot because we embarked on advertising posts, interviewing, and negotiating. So we became more open and staying in the system also, and in the public service, we introduced what we call the open performance review appraisal system instead of the confidential assessment that used to be there, which also could be subjected to favoritism and nepotism. And that one also, I think, gave people confidence that you are joining an institution that has some standards and procedures and rules.
And what criteria are used in promotions? And what weightings are things like seniority, education, skills, or performance management given, or performance evaluations given?
Apart from what I know on OPRAs, which is, so you set your own objectives, individual objectives at the beginning of the year, and when you succeed, you could be promoted. But somehow, if there was a vacancy, if there's no vacancy, then someone cannot just be promoted. But when there's vacancy, the right candidate is sought around and is promoted. We have recently, from what I know, decentralized most of the recruitment and promotion to the accounting officers, and therefore, much as the public service management maintains the standard for which someone should look, we have what we call standing order. A standing order describes exactly how you should promote and who should be promoted as a guide towards the managers who are doing this. But it is more based on seniority and the qualification and the ability to do that. Experience also comes into play. And therefore, it isn't so much different from when you hire from a private company.
Right. And do you have any tests or standards for recruitment? Could you talk about those if you have any experience with them?
What do you mean by standard?
When you recruit people, do you have a set of standards that people need to meet before they can be considered? And what do you look for in the interviews?
Depending on the level of, depending on the level of which you are recruiting, definitely you look for the education, and then you look at the experience and, you know, relevant experience, as well as age. We sometimes look at the age, gender. Now we have a unit, fully a unit that is dealing with diversity issues, and some of the standing regulations is the you need to not to look at the gender, but rather to look at the diverse issues that are around. So if you have a disabled person who is performing well, and he gets the first priority to be hired, so is with women and men. So when the man and the woman, they compete exactly the same, chances are you will take the woman more than the, so that we achieve the Beijing affirmative action, and our government is quite committed to that.
Okay, and some countries, for efficiency or other reasons, formal procedures are not always followed to the letter. Mm-hmm. What is your experience here?
Well, I would think it's only in a few instances where they are not so much followed. So. And it will be for a reason. Some of the things, you see, like the powers vested on the president. He has the power to appoint anybody to any position that he feels that. So it is in the Constitution. Short of that, then you have to follow the procedures.
And is this a change from the past?
Not to the West. But, you know, because even the current situation is different from the past, and therefore, it depends on the situation.
All right. You see, you described nepotism in the civil service earlier. How did you, presumably, the current procedures are different, and there are procedures now rather than just hiring in those ways. Could you talk about how you changed the methods for hiring to get away from nepotism to more standard-based systems?
It was when we introduced the transparency issue of you advertise and more people are involved in the recruitment. We have a committee that is responsible for recruitment, which is diverse also in nature, and therefore every process is subjected to scrutiny by more than one eye, I mean one person. So that, to some extent, reduced a lot of that nepotism issue.
One of the challenges often facing civil service is the implementation of performance management. And you talked about the performance management scheme earlier. Could you describe to me the process of performance management and evaluation?
The performance management system has a lot of areas that were dealt with. We had even monitoring and evaluation. We had strategic planning, operational planning. Systemic planning for the government so that you come up with a work plan that you can execute. One of also another area was the OPRAS, which is the Open Performance Appraisal System. This one is after the organization has set, you know, because we normally with the PMS, you develop the strategy plan involving almost everybody in the organization. And the objectives that are set, each division takes one of the objectives and implements it, breaks it down into sectional objectives and also to individual objectives. So each one knows the stake he has in achieving the higher, the top objective of the organization, as well as these objectives are also, again, in line with the national strategy. So when you have set your standard after you fill in the form at the beginning of the year with your supervisor, then and half yearly you review this your performance against the set targets. Therefore, if you find your performance is lagging behind or you have improved, then those are documented in the form. We have a specific form that is filled in. And the individual assesses his performance first, and then at the due date when they have to do this evaluation, then they sit with the supervisor, and the supervisor now assesses the marks for which the individual has put down, and they compromise on whether that was really what he deserved or she deserved. And they come to an agreement, and then that's how you assess. If someone needs some training because of for which he couldn't perform or couldn't perform, then that one is amicably agreed. You could have someone who witnesses that evaluation as well when someone needs to.
What were the major challenges in introducing the performance management schemes?
Introducing the tools was a challenge to the most MDAs, ministries, departments, and agencies. When we developed them, we tested them piloting some few ministries first for them. POPSM, Minister of Finance, Minister of Planning and Privatization then, and Minister of Health.
Why did you choose those?
First, these are the three are central, and the other one is the sectoral ministry. Therefore, we kind of looked at ones that were not so widespread and the one that was widespread to give us the inkling of how we should introduce them. And then we engaged the consultants to take the MDAs through the process.
Who were these consultants?
They were international consultants. Yeah, we recruited them internationally, and each consultant took a set of ministries. We did divide the ministries into their mandates. Like we had administrative ministries, we had economic ministries, we had the social ministries, and the like. So it took quite a long time to recruit the consultancies and as well as take the ministries in the process.
And did you encounter any challenges?
Some of the challenge was it was new. These were new tools being introduced. So buy-in was really very difficult. The consultants were always complaining that they are not getting the full support.
Who weren't they being supported by?
It was, you know, you're coming in with your new thing, and people had their own things and the way they were doing things. They didn't want to lose their comfort zone for you to sit with them to start planning something they don't know. So slowly, those who, because we didn't put an incentive, there was a fund. There was a fund that the NMDA that completes the cycle of performance management could access for its reform implementation. We called it Performance Improvement Fund. So those champion ministries, when other ministries saw that they were getting the funds and to implement their activities, then they also followed suit. Although the fund was not to last long, but it was give them some inertia to move towards it.
And where did the money for the fund come from? Was it from donors or was it from?
It was from donors.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was there a broad base of support for these programs in the community or society? Or was it, and how did the public react to them?
The reforms in the initial years was seen as being driven by the ministries and being, you know, top-down approach. It was seen as a top-down approach, something that they didn't conceive, and therefore they couldn't know how to implement. So the first civil service was designed that way first, but with the public service reform program, we involved more stakeholders. We even carried out a symposium that involved even political people, politicians, and even then, it is also seemed still to be driven by some circles rather than being owned fully by the citizen. So we embarked on education, information education and communication campaigns. We would, you know, we now like hold the public service day, which is a whole week of events of public service. It's open to public. They ask questions and all that. So it's becoming more understood by the wider public than it used to.
So looking back at the changes with regards to professionalization and merit recruitment, what would you say worked particularly well? And have these become institutionalized?
Well, there were gains that we are seeing for those who embarked on meritocracy. The organizations were well managed. People could speak the same language because of the understanding. Therefore, for those who embarked on that, the capacity to implement was better, and the performance of the institution was also seen. For those who didn't, some ministries, you still find there is the quality of services poor. So it's all about the quality.
And do you think the civil service provides an atmosphere in which, an environment in which civil servants can do their jobs effectively?
The earlier public service was suffering from a lot of lack of capacity in terms of tools, to working tools, good, you know, office accommodation like this one. There was hardly to find in the public service. But as the reform set in, this is changing. Even the earlier reform program, public service reform phase one, some of the resources were spent on retooling the offices and also building the capacity on the terms of human resource. So most of the people went for training, for skills and competence training to make them perform better. Therefore, I think with the reforms, things are changing to the better.
I wonder if I could talk to you now about the sequencing and management of the reform process.
Mm-hmm.
And what exactly your job as the coordinator is to do with regards to the sequencing.
Mm-hmm. The sequencing of the reform is not the sole responsibility of the coordinator. Rather, it emerged from when we are designing the program. And knowing that you cannot do everything at the same time. And this, I might particularly say that the sequencing of this particular program has given it the edge to perform better, because you could come back and see where did you go wrong and rectify faster, because you have that opportunity for reviews and all that. As for me as a coordinator, also gives me the opportunity to do piecemeal achievements, and therefore you show results faster, and therefore you could be trusted for the next phase. That kind of situation. That's how it has come about. So it is important for any reform, because reforms will always be there. There's no way reforms are going to end. And therefore, with the changing world and the globe, the interactions around the world nowadays, we can't say you are through with reforms. So they will continue being there, and the sequence comes out of the need of the day, need of the day.
And what advice would you give other reformers with regards to sequencing of reforms?
It is important that they sequence the reforms, because we have seen others that could not take off because of lack for sequencing, and also being able to articulate what can you do now and break it into components that you can achieve, setting in the in a logical framework the outcomes that are expected of that phase. And we normally develop what we call triggers, which is what triggers you to do what you want to do, and those are measured in the final analysis when you are implementing.
So could you give me an example of a trigger?
It's like when we said all MDAs should be on the performance management system. Yeah. So someone coming in, looking at the MDA and finding, using the OPRAS forms and things like that. Or you can say developing quick win, several of them for a certain period of time.
And have some reforms proved difficult to complete because other reforms haven't taken place? Or have some reforms undercut others?
Yes. There are several cross-cutting reforms like ours. We have the legal sector, we have the financial. So these, we call them cross-cutting reforms. They are crucial for every reform because they're interdependent. They depend on each other in terms of, for public service reform program is supposed to have ensure capacity is there in the public service to implement the other reforms. The legal sector needs to see into how efficient the legal system is working so that people are comfortable. Therefore, some reforms have suffered because others didn't take place, especially the local government reform program, which depends almost on all cross-cutting reforms. So there's need for them to go in the same pace. Unfortunately, what we found is most reforms do not start on the same time. So others came later, and therefore the issue of reform not being run smoothly because others are lagging behind.
So you've talked a lot about the government evaluating its core areas of responsibility. And could you talk a little bit more about what those areas are, what you decided those areas are to focus on?
Yeah, one that I know for sure is the policy formulation and development and the issue of rule of law. So policies are what the guides everybody else to do and to behave. So when they are not to the standard, they are not to the expectations of the stakeholders, then things don't go right. So mostly those are the core areas of every ministry that is around, rather than really the doing of the issues as we used to do earlier on. You leave the doing to private sector. Unfortunately, the Tanzanian private sector had not developed well. So that's why you find government still holding on to some few of those areas that could have been privatized.
All right. And how is this? How's the reform process fit in with these, with the goals of streamlining government?
The especially the cross-cutting reforms are there to help the government perform, and therefore some of the key result areas of this reform should focus on the improvement in terms of policy development by all the ministries. And like our public service reform, that is a key result area for one of the components.
And how broad has the implementation of the reforms been? You talked about the pilot project with the performance management, but in other areas?
After the pilot, of course, we rolled over to all the MDAs. The second phase of public service reform program is designed now that it's not driven from the center, because the earlier one was being driven from POPSM on what we call the supply-driven. But now it's we designed it that the MDA will manage their own reforms, and we give them resources. And therefore, now it has cascaded down to the MDAs, and we took them through a facilitation process of how they should choose the reform agenda in their respective ministries. And it has proved to be quite receptive by the MDAs. We recently had a supervision mission, actually it lasted only last week, and when they went around to the MDAs, they were just saying, we are happy that POPSM has really relinquished the powers to us to manage the reforms, and that we were facilitated well by them in taking them up. That were the first round of facilitation we intend to do also to the executive agencies, as well as to independent departments, and then later on it will seem a natural course, because now reforms are mainstreamed into the MDA's, what we call medium-term expenditure framework. They plan for them, they put the money in their plans, and they implement. So they just give us reports of implementation, and then we consolidate the reports for further reporting.
So some countries have cited the problem of keeping reforms in place after the official reform process has been completed. What mechanisms have you used to help continuity of political reform as people move in and out of industries or ministries?
With the attrition of people, we have our program, we have mainstreamed the program. It's not more managed as a unit. Some reforms were implemented in a unit form where you had a chief executive and those who were implementing experts for that matter. But our reform is now mainstream. So the directors, it is mainstream to the structure of the ministry. and therefore implementation is now not done by the expert. For us, we just facilitate them out, but by themselves, you know, identifying the areas of implementation, this plan from the section up to the directorate, up to the institution. So sustainability becomes more relevant, but those which are still on the project mode, then they risk when people leave and they are all stagnant.
All right. How have the ministries reacted to this mainstreaming, making reforms part of their jobs? Have they felt that this has added to their workload or stretched their capacity? And how have you dealt with that?
It also occurred here when the program was mainstreamed, but we kept on informing and educating them that their core business, whatever they are doing, is what they are supposed to reform in the first instance, not something coming from outside. And therefore, it is just making their work to be done in a better and more informed way. So slowly they understood that. But even as we were going to the ministry, such kind of feeling was there that, you are coming to add more work into us. How can we do your reform work and then do our normal work? So the challenge remains on how to tell them that what you are doing is a reform. What you are doing currently is what needs to be reformed, and therefore a plan for that. For us here, it was quite, it took some time, but once they knew that was part of the job, then they now do it on a usual manner rather than calling it a reform. So that's why mainstreaming of the reform is important at the NL stage.
Right, and how has the availability of resources affected the way you've conducted reforms, or the types of reforms that you've chosen to implement?
Resources are important because for lack of them you cannot implement the reforms, because there's a lot of capacity building, there's a lot of consultancies to bring in, technical assistances, and therefore for you to access the resources is how you use the resources. For those programs that have used the resources for the intended purposes, they have continued to be supported. For those then who will not understand the rules and the procedures, then they are stuck. So some of the reforms are stuck because of, I wouldn't say misuse, but for not using the resources for the intended purposes.
All right, so is there a system where resources are only provided if results through?
Yeah, because you sign an MOU, we sign the credit agreement, and that is all stipulated. So when they come to review and they find you out of your way, immediately they suspend.
Okay, so
it's suspension of the loan.
Who's suspending this loan?
The bank can suspend, and so the borrower is the Minister of Finance. It's informed that this program is not performing, or it has done something very erroneously here. So we are suspending, and there are stages to suspend the program. You first inform, then you ask for explanation. If you don't get any satisfactory explanation, then it goes into the board of the World Bank, and then it is suspended.
Okay.
Yeah.
And could you talk about the skills needed for reform and the capacity demands of reform? What was the skills base in this also at the beginning of the reform? And did you need to bring in any external help?
Reforms need skills and experience. And therefore, we did bring in advisors. For each component, there was an advisor who stayed for about 2 years with the directors. And after that, then we had a few experts again to sustain the capacity of the public service. So now some of the components do not have either an advisor nor an expert, only in a few areas. But you really need the capacity for people who will see the urgency, because undertaking reforms needs a speed to implement, And the fact that most of the reforms are on a project mode, I mean, in terms of development, and they have a time frame for implementation, then you need to keep the momentum for implementation.
And have you made distinctions between long-term and short-term goals? And have these ever pulled in different directions?
Normally, we align them in terms of achievements. So long-term goals still are there, but you have to develop short-term goals to achieve that long-term goal. So like our Vision 2025, which in the Mkokuta, each we have three clusters of the Mkokuta, so each one finds where he fits and then develops what will achieve the Mkokuta strategy and the Mkokuta goal.
And who's been in charge of the reform process? Who's been managing the reform process? Is it a single person? Is it mainly through POPSM? And how is that related to delegation into the ministries?
Who was managing the reform from early on was the chief secretary, who is the head of the public service. So he has the permanent secretary below him for accountability and reporting. And therefore, each reform has a steering committee that is chaired by the by the chief secretary. Of recent, because we have developed what we call a national framework for coordination of the reforms, and also we have established a unit under the chief secretary. So this unit sits with the chief secretary in the State House, and is the one which is responsible for coordinating and informing the head of the public service about what is happening with each reform. So he is the one who is in charge of all the reforms.
And how have the reforms affected, we've talked about this a little before, but how have the reforms affected the workloads that people already have?
In terms of affecting, it is only misunderstanding. So even here, when we introduced the reform, we said they are mainstreamed. We didn't give people time to think about it. It was just they are no experts anymore. We don't have a unit for projects. So you are the ones. So the permanent secretary sat in a meeting in the conference room and told the directors, you have conceived the baby and you have to deliver it. So that's how it rolled over. So you need bold decisions by the leaders. That's how it happened here. So I think in others, they are hesitant about that. So people keep on saying, I have other duties. I cannot do the reform duties. So that is where someone needs to come in and tell them what you are doing is what you need to improve, and that becomes a reform.
Yeah. All right. And if you were to have any advice for other countries, for other people in other countries about controlling and managing reforms, what would it be?
To have a good leader to lead the reforms, a leader or a manager for that matter. Because reforms, I think, is not more about leadership; it's more about managing, and asking for results all the time. Here, we did put an institutional arrangement whereby every after 2 weeks, someone have to come and report on a reform issue. So it became part of their system. They hived off all the thinking they had, so they would sit on Friday, they know Monday we have a meeting for reporting. That one brought them on board faster. And when you sit in a meeting, conducting effective meeting means not listening to the processes rather than the outcomes or the constraints. Someone will just have to say what constraints you are facing in achieving your milestone that you had set. If they find there's a constraint, the permanent secretary asks, who do you think needs to help you on that? So that way, you find people coming with solutions and rather than problems.
Now, I wonder if I could talk about the organizational structure of the civil service. And have you made any large-scale structural organizational changes?
Well, yeah, there have been. Actually, when the president appoints the cabinet, normally that signals the restructuring in some ministries and some departments, and therefore calls for everybody to do the restructuring. This ministry is responsible for facilitating restructuring of the institution. So they do apply, they bring in their suggestions, and then we sit with them, we look at the structure and the mandate. When you look at the mandate of the organization for which it's been vested, then you know what structure will be able, best structure to implement the mandate. And therefore, they have happened several times, because ministries have changed. We had 18, they went to 24, they come back. Sometimes this ministry is merged with another one. So restructuring happens almost all the time.
And has there been any changes in the way, in the career paths of civil servants?
Sorry?
Have there been any changes in the career paths of civil servants?
Career path?
Yeah.
Well, people who join at the lower level, they expect to be the directors and later on to be permanent secretaries. So the more higher it goes, the less the vacancies exist. And therefore, if you don't succeed to reach the top, you are either can go horizontal to another ministry and do something different. But otherwise, they are quite, once you are a director, it's almost like you reach the top and you stay there.
How much security of tenure, how much job security do civil servants have? And how does this affect their efficiency and accountability?
I'm not a public servant myself, so I wouldn't be able to answer that very well, except I know they are permanent and pensionable. I know they are permanent and pensionable, and therefore when they reach 60, they have to retire. Yeah.
Okay. I wonder if I could talk a little bit about pay policy. I know you mentioned it earlier. As well as the retrenchment in staff size. So were you involved at all in the retrenchment process in the 1990s?
No, I had not joined, but when I joined, I found there was a program known as redeployment. So when they retrenched about 50,000 or so employees, then they set up a redeployment program, which they call like retrenching with a smile, so that at least someone doesn't feel. So there were two issues to redeployment. One was those who were retrenched, they were given some fund to attend training in entrepreneurship development. And others were given funds to start small business. Attend a training program and start a small business through a voucher. There was a voucher system that was used. It proved to others it did help, because after all, they were people whom you could not deploy back into the service. Retrenchment came with the notion that those who will remain will be remunerated better. That didn't happen, because the few that were retrenched could not really cut or increase. It was like a drop in the ocean. And therefore, the expectations were not met by the retrenchment per se, but it is an exercise that was done without so much chaos like it is happening in other countries. Here they cannot even mention about it. So here it was done smoothly somehow, but the redeployment also lasted for about 2-3 years, and then it also ceased because there was multi-practice. You couldn't follow the retrenchees to the villages, considering how large Tanzania is. So it didn't increase the wage, and people perceived it to be a loose thing that was undertaken. However, it remains a credit that we managed to retrench 50,000 employees without so much havoc and cause.
And so why do you think you were able to retrench them effectively?
I think they managed because first there was a campaign that was undertaken and information people were given, because others actually volunteered to be retrenched because the handshake was good. So only to find that after some time of spending that money, you cannot sustain you with that. So then it becomes a bitter pill. Sweet as it was in the beginning, it became a bitter pill. So, and Tanzanian culture is not that much. It wasn't during that time a culture resistance. Tanzanian culture has always been, perhaps it's the best way that we are being told and all that. It's a listening culture. Yes.
Okay. And in the pay, policy, what were the attempts made to increase the level of pay in the civil service?
I'm not very confident in that topic of pay, but what I know is they have what they call a ceiling, and they have to adhere to medium-term pay targets that have been set. And as usual, pay will all depend on the capacity of the government to pay. So if the revenue is not increasing, then pay increase also becomes a problem. But over the period of the reforms, and pay has increased substantially, and I think it's somehow other people might have given you a better data on what level they have moved here.
Have you had any experience with the training programs or capacity building efforts in the civil service reform? And were there any efforts to identify gaps in capacity? And how did you go about identifying these gaps?
Training needs assessment were conducted in several times, and training plan are now being developed. But as you know, the capacity of the public service was very low. There wasn't any capacity. So any capacity intervention that was undertaken was more on a need basis or an ad hoc basis rather than a concerted effort that you could know across the board who needs to be trained and in what and the sequence for training. So most of the capacity interventions that have been undertaken are more spontaneous, and of recent, the only ones that we have done systematically is on leadership development, whereby we have given it across the board to, let's say, all the district executive directors, or you give it to all the district administrative secretaries, the same course for, you know, in a sequence manner. So otherwise, this is a challenge now, and this reform program, the current phase, is now looking into more how they can do a structured capacity building.
And who does most of the training?
Training is conducted in country and as well as abroad. And where we need to train in mass, then we bring in the trainers who train in the country. So it's cheaper and you cover more people. But otherwise, there are local institutions as well as international institutions and consultants who are trainers.
And has there been any relationship with tertiary institutions?
Like
the University of Dar es Salaam or the Public Service College?
The Tanzania Public Service College trains the lower cadre of the employees. University of Dar es Salaam, you'll only train on the academic part of it, like if you want to send people for master's degrees, then that one is people go to university. And also we have a program for women where we sponsor about 50 women each year to undertake a master's program. So they undergo a master's program in any university in Tanzania. We don't send them abroad.
How many people do you normally send abroad every year?
I think less than 30.
Okay.
Less than 30.
And is it a concern that people who are trained leave the civil service and find better employment in the private sector?
It's very few, because the type of people that are trained would have their positions already in the public service. Earlier on, the government used to have what they called a bond, because, you know, so that you promise to work for the government. But nowadays, I don't think it's there. I don't know. But for skills enhancement and capacity enhancement, we all sent in service, so they will definitely come back. We don't train for first degree or things like that.
And how have you gone about attracting the scarce skills into the public sector? And what sort of skills have these typically been?
Yeah. Attracting and retaining these technical and professional staff is quite a challenge. So I think there's a scale they have set for them. Entry point is different from the normal cadre, what they call normal cadre. So technical and professional are more, I think they are paid better, more compared to the other colleagues. There have been some what they call the LCC by the donors, so that they could keep it, especially during the reform process. You give them top up. But these of recent have become quite unpopular because of the sustainability issue. You cannot sustain. So what has happened to keep them is improve the working environment.
So how has the environment improved?
Better equip them with computers, build a new office accommodation, so at least the people feel they are recognized when they're working. It's not like where we're coming from. It was terrible. But nowadays, I think someone coming to join our institution will definitely join, because we have a big, nice building. You see, the office I'm staying in is an old office. So they would call them huts. But when they find a building nice as this, they have joined, they will join. And it's no problem really getting young graduates joining the public service, because even in the private sector is not grown, and therefore the only opportunity they have is the public service, which is the largest employer. Yeah. So there's an advantage that it has the capacity to employ.
And do they get other benefits?
Depending on your position, I think there are benefits that are given to the permanent secretaries, directors. Yeah. Fringe benefits exist for them. Yeah.
Has there been any effort to involve the public in setting goals, or involved in the reform process to get any grassroots feedback?
Yeah, like in our program, when we develop the program, we do involve them. Yeah, the private sector, NGOs, we call them into a seminar, we sensitize them on what we want to do. We commission consultants to go around and seek for their advice and way forward. So that one gives you really a very good input into where you want to go and how you should go and how you should involve them.
And what sort of feedback have you got from them with regards to goals? What are the priorities of the private sector, of the NGOs, and of the public?
Mm-hmm. Each one of them, you know, because we do stakeholder analysis, each one of them have a different need. and would like to be involved in a different manner. So, like the private sector would want the policies to be clear, well updated most of the time, the services that they get from the public institution to be efficient on time, which almost everybody wants that. The non-state actors need to be involved in all stages of policy development. They want to be their voices to be heard. And therefore, we even have set up a complaints handling mechanism where they can complain, and these complaints are taken up. So it has changed, the public service relationship with the other organs has completely changed. It's not like the confidential type of situation that existed and that existed earlier on.
So could you talk a little bit more about the complaints handling mechanism? Mm-hmm. How do people leave complaints?
You can do it through writing in the newspaper. There are people who are always looking for complaints in the newspaper. You can leave it in suggestion boxes. There are suggestion boxes in offices. You can report directly to anybody you think, or the permanent secretary or the minister. And we have instituted a system where you now these are systematically responded to, and we have put in a time frame for responding to those which are within certain limits. And another tool that we have developed is the client service charter. So this client service charter gives our customers and clients a framework for which to start complaining, because otherwise they cannot complain on something that is within or without our capacity and capability. Therefore, the client service charters of each institution sets out the time frame how to be handled in terms of the service delivery. So that forms the basis for complaints.
So religious or cultural divisions or language differences can complicate service delivery. Have you encountered any problems like that in Tanzania?
Not really, because of our cultural background and social background and our bringing as a nation by Mwalimu Nyerere. So we are quite a homogeneous society that works together quite well. If it will happen, it will be on an individual basis, but not, because some of the values of public service is impartiality to people. So you cannot practice politics in the office, nor religion, and tolerance has to exist within society. And of advantage is the use of Swahili across the board, which everybody can communicate with now.
So I'm wondering, what is the relationship between the Zanzibar public service? Is it separate from the mainland?
It is part of the reform, actually. The strategy for reform in this office takes into consideration the Zanzibar reforms. So the public service reform of Zanzibar and this one, they are working together. Only theirs is a bit behind, but we are putting them on board.
And are there any aspects of the design or implementation of reform that reflect local traditions or cultural practices, specifically Tanzanian ways of doing things that may not be transferable to other areas?
I think it's a level of tolerance, which I mean, when you might want to do it very fast. Tanzania is quite a go-easy society. And therefore, you have to put out the learning curve and doing it in a pace they think is reasonable for them. So they don't rush into things, and especially if they don't understand what it is. We don't know about our future. This new generation also is coming up with a different way of approaching issues. And therefore it might change. But otherwise, since we've been quite a closed society, so even things move in a closed manner and in our own pace.
Thank you very much. I've just got one question to finish off. And that's, if you had a chance to write a handbook for people who are to manage civil service reform, what kinds of topics would you consider most important? And so what would make this handbook most useful to you if you were starting at the beginning again?
I think you put the issues of commitment by top leadership to really want to change and to carry the reform further. And to walk the talk, walk the talk. Otherwise, Tanzania, sometimes they talk too much and walk less. So talk the talk and to persevere, because nothing good comes easy. And therefore, you have to constantly keep on coaching and offering feedback so that people feel comfortable about taking reforms. Otherwise, it's not something that you leave in a book and you assume someone will really take it up and know what to do with it. So it needs constant coaching and reminding and celebrating little successes that come along that, and giving people hope that it's going to deliver what it promises to do. And it should be very participatory, for it to work efficiently and faster.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Andrew.